Hey everybody, I'm Matt Valley, and welcome to episode number 95 of the Rock and Roll Research Podcast, where we share the super cool backstories and side gigs of the research and insights pros that you trust. Now, today's guest hardly needs an introduction. I say that because coming out of the recent QRCA conference and then IIEX in Austin a couple weeks ago, a lot of people came up to me and said, "Hey, Matt, do you know Rob Volpe?" It's kind of the talk of the town, I must say. And I had heard of Rob, but I didn't know him. So super excited to say that now that I do. And now you will too, if you don't already. So Rob is the CEO and founder of a really cool company called Ignite 360. They do consumer and strategy work. It's a small but mighty firm. I know a couple people on staff there, so I know that you hire the best and the brightest, so that's really cool. And is also founded on curiosity and empathy, which is a very important word to Rob. So in addition to that, Rob is an award-winning author of the book. You can see, if you're watching this, you can see it's up there on his wall. Tell me more about that. Solving the Empathy Crisis, One Conversation at a Time. There it is. Perfect. Perfect.
With the award sticker now added.
There you go.
Through the book.
It's a really cool book because it's what I would consider a crossover book. It's not just bought by researchers. Many people in the general public have gotten lots of use from it as well. So we're going to talk about all that and more on today's podcast. So welcome to the show, Rob.
Yeah, thank you so much. It's so great to be here.
I'm glad
you heard my name a couple times this spring, and we were able to connect and start talking, and led us to this.
Yeah, totally. I'm super excited to be sitting here with you and digging into this stuff. So I know we've chatted a little bit about some of these things, but I'm really looking forward to digging into some of the details. So let's go way back, Rob. Everybody's got an origin story in research. Tell us a little bit about how you got into research in the first place and a little bit about Ignite 360. Give us the journey. Sure.
Yeah. How did I get into research in the first place? Was through ignoring signs that the universe was putting in front of me that, hey, maybe qualitative research would be something that I'd enjoy. I got into marketing. So I'll be 55 this year. So back in the 90s, I left college, graduated in 91, started working in Hollywood, realized marketing was the thing I was really excited about, and understanding how to influence human behavior. That sounds a little like, you know, insights might be useful there. Yeah. Even early on when I was at working in Hollywood, I had applied for a job at Fox Broadcasting. And this is back in the early days when like the original 90210.
Oh yeah. I remember that.
All that. Yeah. And I'd applied for a job in the research department because I was fascinated. I grew up, the local paper used to print the ratings every week for all the TV shows. And I was just fascinated by how things were performing and what did well on which night. And, you know, you could see all the detail. And then I went to Syracuse. I went to the Newhouse School, you know, well-known, well-respected communications program, took a class on network television programming. And I was like, oh my God, this is it. But it was all about the research and the understanding of how people were behaving and then how you might be able to influence that behavior, yeah, change that behavior based on the data and what you were learning. I didn't get that job. I was second. And they let me know that I was second, which was just like, why are you telling me that? Like, am I supposed to feel better or what? But that was the first sort of brush with a possible career. And that probably would have taken me down a quant rabbit hole that might not have been the best suited thing for me, ultimately, when I think about who I am and where my gifts really lie.
Sure.
So then jump forward, I get into marketing in the mid 90s. And back then it was a less evolved space than it is today and less fragmented even in the disciplines. And I landed at a PR firm and we started doing promotional programs for Starbucks. And Starbucks had a, so they were a client. They had a joint venture with what was Dreyer's Edie's ice cream. Those brands are still out there. They're owned by Nestle now, I think. But they had a joint venture and they were producing Starbucks ice cream. Really awesome coffee flavored ice cream.
It was like, so good. I remember
amazing stuff. I don't understand why it went away. It was really good. And Starbucks back in the day wasn't doing a lot of advertising. So it was all grassroots word of mouth PR, which is why they came to us and said, hey, can you create an event or a series of events where we go to local festivals or street fairs and sample Starbucks ice cream and hand out samples and get the word out? Sure. How hard could that be? So I spent the summer of 1996 traveling the United States, figuring out how to temper half quarts of ice cream that were coming off of the truck at like 0 degrees, which you cannot scoop at that temperature. Right. How long would it take to get it up to a scoopable temperature from the time it comes off of the truck to, you know, when we needed the samples? And, you know, of course it's like ice cream. Who doesn't want ice cream?
Yeah.
So, and the answer to this is, it depends on the weather conditions. Like in hot and humid climates, like I remember we were at Coconut Grove in Miami area, and man, that stuff would turn to mush in minutes. So you were really like just in time sort of scooping. And then we were in Tucson a few weeks later and it's so dry that you're just like, you know, 20 minutes later and it's still like you could pound nails with the ice cream. It's so hard. But part of that was, though, that and how it ties into research, aside from figuring the ice cream tempering part, was having that opportunity to connect with the consumer and to see their reaction, engage their reaction, and hear what they were saying when they tried it. What did they like or not? Where did they expect to find it? What were their concerns? Yeah. And I would take that and I'd report it back to the clients as part of, you know, I'd have to do a write-up after every event. And I'd share it and they were like, wow, this is like research. This is, you know, as well as a report on a sampling event. So it was giving them a lot of really good on the ground feedback. And I mean, still didn't do anything with it. It was kind of like, yeah, great. This is fun. Woo. I'm just going to keep going and, you know, went on my way. And then 7 years, I was working at Kraft Foods in Westchester, back when they had offices in upstate or the Westchester area outside of New York City. And I was working in the coffee team. So Maxwell House and then also Starbucks when they had that partnership, which then fell apart. But anyway, so we were trying to figure out the insights team there. I was working in consumer promotions. So we were doing cons and other partnerships. So it's still in this promotional space.
Sure.
The insights team working on Maxwell House was trying to understand if there might be an unlock for some of our instant soluble products with people from the Caribbean, of Caribbean descent, living in New York or living in the United States. So they got some money and we did some, they did some ethnographies. And they knew that I was really into the research and going out in qual. Like they could see. I think you can kind of tell when, like, oh, they've got the curiosity. They've got that, you know, they could be a good insights person. Because I was the one, like, when there were focus groups, I'd be the first person there and the last person to leave. Like, brand managers would be coming in and out. They weren't on Facebook at the time. It was before those days. But they were doing other things, eating M&Ms.
Yeah.
And I was like riveted, like what's the consumer saying? Because it's such a gift. It's the most to me, like that's the person that's buying your product. If you don't listen to them, you don't have a business. So that to me, it's elemental that you would be doing that and taking the time. That was the most important thing. So anyway, they gave me this opportunity to go on some in-homes in New York City with people of Caribbean Hispanic descent that were, they all spoke Spanish. The sessions were in Spanish. I do not speak Spanish. And yet I understood everything that was going on. I was like, it was fascinating to hear, you know, and see and experience being in somebody else's home. And that's, I mean, even then I still like, I loved the moment, but I still wasn't like, gee, how do I get to go do that?
Yeah.
So again, like how many different times do I need to miss the signal that's being put in front of me of like, hey, dummy, you might like this. And then a few years after that, we'd moved out here. I was working at a toy company doing promotional marketing. I got laid off. But at that point, I had been on the, there used to be a circuit of, like, there's a circuit of research conferences.
Mm-hmm.
There was a circuit of conferences for people that were in youth marketing. And so I was known in that circuit because I was presenting and just meeting people there.
Sure.
And so when I got laid off, several of the research groups that specialize in youth marketing reached out, or kid products or all family things reached out, and they were like, oh, hey, we could use some help. So I started doing some behind the scenes things. And then one fateful night, Wynn Tyree, who's the owner of Smarty Pants, she and her husband Radamas were out here in San Francisco. And so my husband Charles and I, we got together, the four of us. We went to Burma Superstar over in the Richmond area district here in the city. So if anybody that knows San Francisco, they know that restaurant. And she said to me, I'm looking to hire someone that's just like you that can do the deck writing and the strategic thinking, but also knows how to moderate.
Yeah.
And then I went, you know, and I'm a helpful person. So I start to play the name game and like, oh, who could fit that and everything. 3 days later, I'm like at an outdoor swimming pool. It's lunchtime. The sun's shining. I'm doing the backstroke. And all of a sudden it hits me. Oh, wait a minute. I like talking to people. Maybe I'd be good at moderating.
Yeah.
So I reached out to a friend immediately. Like I think I was in the car on the way home, or as soon as I got home from the pool, I called a friend who had her own research practice. And I was like, hey, what do you think of this? And she's like, oh my God, you'd be great. Go to Riva, get trained, and then let me know, and I'll see if I can use you on a project. 6 weeks, 2 months later, it was Martin Luther King weekend, 2007. I was at Riva in Silver Spring. Naomi Henderson trained me. It was life-changing in those 3 days. It was the most amazing thing. And a month after that, I was standing in the frozen vegetable aisle of a Walmart in Allentown, Pennsylvania, waiting patiently to see if any shopper would possibly notice a new Green Giant test product that General Mills was testing.
Yeah.
And I was hooked. And that's how I got started.
That is so awesome. That is so awesome. There's so many interesting threads. It's funny, even when you talked about missing the signal, right? And then even when it was totally thrown in your lap, it took a few days to say, wait a second.
I didn't see the path forward. And I think that's one of the things that I try to do with people that are curious about the industry is show like, here's the path. And especially on the quant, there's a little bit more of a tried and true, you know, it's just such a much bigger side of the business. There's so many little, you know, not little, but junior analyst jobs and entry points and ways in, but moderating, and especially the sort of wisdom that I think a moderator needs to have, and wisdom from life experiences and being able to like read people like that. Some of that is you just learn through time.
Yeah.
And maturity, and like, so what are the steps and how do you get somebody into and through that process? And so for me, like I said, like, it wasn't obvious, like, oh, here you go. It took somebody to point it out, like, go to Riva and then, you know, let me know when you're done. And I was resisting taking a corporate job and continuing on that promotional marketing career during that layoff in 2006. So I was very open to whatever might be next. And I was doing all sorts of, I mean, it was the gig economy before the gig economy was a thing.
Yeah.
And then this turned into a really big gig.
Super cool. So real quick, tell us about the decision to start Ignite 360 and a little bit about what you specialize in.
Yeah, so I was doing a ton of qualitative work. I was a contractor with this other firm, a friend's practice, and we grew quite nicely. And it got to the point where I was working so much for her. It was kind of obvious And according to California law, I would need to become an employee.
Right.
But I have a bit of a, as she described it, which I think is very accurate, I have an allergic, I have an allergy to the word employee as it relates to me. apparently when it would come up in conversation, I wouldn't realize I was doing it, but there was like a little scrunchy face that I was making. So, you know, I thought about it and I was like, all right, you know, I could do this, but could there be equity involved? Because I work really hard, I take ownership. And it was a really interesting thing. For some reason at that time, in that phase in the 2000s, I was thinking that I was more like, you know, I can get shit done, which is true. But maybe I'm not the actual person to be the CEO and to lead and be the full-on entrepreneur. Maybe I'm the really strong number two that can just get shit done and, you know, fuel through might and force of will, make things happen. And I was happy. I was doing that, you know, for a few years. So anyway, we have this conversation. They weren't able to actually give equity at that point. And so it became, all right, well, you know, kind of quote unquote, show me the money. Let's make me an offer. Let's see what that looks like. And they did. Sure. And it was incredibly generous. I mean, it was so much. I don't even know if I make that much money now, to be totally honest. But I got the contract and I was looking at the contract and I still remember the day. I was in my kitchen and it was a gray, cloudy day, kind of like it is today. And I just opened the document up. And in the first few sentences, you know, it has the definitions of who the parties are. And I see my name and then the parenthetical, the quotes and the word employee in large letters. And Matt, every fiber of my being, like from top to bottom, my entire body was screaming out, no, this is not you. Don't do this.
Yeah.
And I couldn't shake it. It wasn't even, you know, sometimes you have like a passing thought and you're like, oh, that's a worry or a concern. This was like a storm cloud, like in my body going, no, no, no. And I was like, all right, shit, I got to listen to that. So that's when I decided, you know what, I can, you know, I'm going to have to do that. I talked to a couple of clients because I had no idea. I was new still into the field. I had no idea how all of this worked.
It's pretty gutsy.
Well, thank you. And I talked to a couple of trusted clients that were, you know, client/friend. And I was just like, how does this work? What's going to happen? And they're like, it's a relationship business. People want to work with you. So they're going to come with you. Yep. And okay. And, you know, I talked to a lawyer. We looked through the papers that I had signed. Like it seemed like everything was relatively clear for me to go do that. And so I made the leap and really with the intention. So that's the kind of events that happened that led up to it. And then it was with the mission of really helping clients get beyond just all the data that they had, you know, and sure. I saw somebody posted, Elizabeth Oates posted a quote the other day of just because you've got data doesn't mean you have insights effectively. You know, you need to understand the why and the context. And what I was seeing at the time was clients, you know, technology is letting us do so many projects at the same time, but you don't have the time to think and like figure out, well, what do we do with that? So as the trusted counsel, you know, agency partner, that's the role that we should be playing, you know, and it's, I don't want to just give you data. I've always in my life, and even with the book and about empathy, it's about how to and what to do with something. So we of course share the what. But then there's the so what and the now what that goes along with that, so that hopefully the teams are inspired. And, you know, we're constantly working on inspiring the teams through great storytelling and empathy building so that they can move on. And that's what Ignite 360 is all about, is inspiring our clients to find that one big idea that's going to move their business forward, because ultimately that's what they want. And that's what we're in this for.
Yeah. I love that. And there's so many interesting threads, I think, you know, knowing a little bit about your backstory, and switching gears a little bit here. So I think about, okay, so now you're an author, right? So you're a CEO and an author and a successful one at that. But then way back, there's something that feels a little bit inevitable about it to me, because I know you've always been very passionate about the causes you're involved in. And you've always, activism has always been, you know, close to your heart. I know it goes all the way back to your Little League baseball team, which is a great story. So tell us a little bit about, you know, that side outside of research, who you are and how that's kind of worked its way to ultimately writing a book and sharing your ideas with a broad swath of people.
Yeah. So growing up, So, you know, I call myself an empathy activist, and I love the tension between those two words. And to me, you know, activism takes many forms. Yes, the obvious one is you're marching out on the street, but even as insights professionals, we are campaigning for change. You know, we're trying to get our stakeholders to do something different, to make a decision. That's a form of activism. And then there's other ways that activism shows up as well. I think if you're volunteering with an organization, that's a form of activism. You're helping the organization achieve their goals. As a kid, my mom really is the one that gets the credit for instilling the activist or instilling, I think, you know, activating the activist gene inside me. She got really involved in the early 70s when I was starting school. She found that there wasn't a preschool vision screening program. And so she got involved in setting one up because what ends up happening is kids, if they isn't determined that they have a vision issue, they may not be able to see the chalkboard. They're not going to learn, you know, because they're sitting back, they need to be up front, they need glasses, whatever. And so she got involved with a program to make that happen. And then there were other, And I mean, so that was really early. And then I write about it in the book. I don't know, it must have been like 1978 or so. Maybe I was 10. The kids in the neighborhood, I was not in Little League, but we did have a T-ball set up. I lived on a cul-de-sac. And so it was the perfect place to, and my house was home base, or the mailbox basically was home base. Yep. And there were T-ball games that would happen. And my friend Joey and I got excluded from a game. And I don't know if it had been an ongoing thing or it was just this one particular time, but the kids basically were like, no, we don't want you to play with us. And it's like, well, wait a minute, that home play, your shit is laying on my like lawn and like you've been using and we've been able to play. This is not right. This is not fair. And we go inside and my mom, I think basically, you know, I think we went inside to complain to my mom and, you know, you would hope that, oh, mom's going to come and pull the mom card and go out and tell the kids to all be nice. And instead she was like, well, you should do something about it. And like, you should protest. And so we made picket signs and went out with our signs and marched in reverse order around, you know, Joey and I alone marched in reverse order around the bases.
And that's so awesome.
Thank you. You know, and it was, I mean, Joey was, we were both scared to death. Joey was like, and the way I got Joey to do it, because he was more hesitant about it than I was. And I was like, well, maybe the newspaper will show up and like, we can, you know, there's some publicity around this and, you know, we'll get more awareness for this cause that kids are unfair and kids can be cruel. And, you know, which was a bigger lesson later on in life, but yeah. So that he kept, we're walking around and, you know, sun's blazing down on us. The other kids were interrupting. They were walking reverse order of the bases. So the kids can't play. They're looking at us like, what the hell are you doing? And Joey's like, when's the newspaper going to show up? When's the photographer going to get here? I'm like, shut up and keep walking. So that was very early activism for me. And then it's continued to follow. And it's, you know, we're recording this in early June. It's Pride Month. I'm a gay man. And once I came out, being supportive and being involved in my community is really, really important to me, and helping with LGBTQ rights. Sure. So I got did a lot in my early 20s. And now, like, what's going on today feels very similar to what was happening back then. And so a friend of mine is working at GLAAD, and I'm been chatting with her about, okay, I'm done. Enough is enough. I'm ready to help again. What are we going to do? So I'm talking to them about getting involved. And I just think it's important. We have to work together to create the world that we want to live in. You know, it's not just going to happen. We can't wish it from our sofa. We have to take action, and you have to find the things that will work for you. So whether that's going onto the street and marching and joining a march, whether that's, you know, working a phone bank, sending out letters, writing a check and making a donation, speaking out on social media, telling, you know, a store member, something I shared on social media this week, I was like, just go to, you know, it's really difficult for those Target team members that work in the stores right now, because they're getting threatened in different places. So it suddenly is scary for them to come to work. Tell them, like, hey, I support you. I appreciate what you're doing, and thank you for, you know, and I'm here for you. And a friend commented on social about it, and she did just that at a Target in Ohio. And she said the employee was just like dumbstruck. Couldn't believe that somebody took that. But it means so much to people to hear that. And so you don't know what one little action, the ripple effect that one little action could have. So my friend saying that to the Target employee in Ohio might change the way she ends up engaging with other people, or even talking about the situation. She may become more open to members of the LGBTQ community herself. And then that is going to have continued domino effects. So, you know, there's a lot of times people look at these big issues and they go, well, what can I do? I'm one person. And it's like, well, exactly. You're one person. You can have one conversation and that can make a change. And that's where the subtitle of the book, Solving the Empathy Crisis, One Conversation at a Time. And what I think about, it's like one person, one conversation at a time. And if I can help that person, that's going to have a ripple effect there, and then having the next conversation, and on and on.
Yeah. You know, as you were, it was actually really fun to listen to your answer, because as you were talking, I just felt like, you know, the original question is, you know, how do we connect these dots? And it just kept swelling and swelling. And I was like, yes, of course, this is what Rob did, was, you know, saw this opportunity, this void of empathy, and taking what you know and your expertise and sharing it with others, so they know how they can help, right?
And yes, and I think even connecting back to what I was saying about the origins of Ignite 360, what I'm all about, which is about the how to, and that is about activism. Right. How do you actually make that happen? And so, yes, thank you for gently redirecting me and saying, Rob, you didn't actually answer my question. So, when I found out about the empathy crisis and the lack of empathy skills, and could see that everywhere, and realizing how critical and important that is, not just to me personally, but to success in life.
Yeah.
It was obvious that we were going to start to coach and train that at Ignite 360. And then that would lead to the book, and then all the speaking engagements. And then all of a sudden, here we are, Matt, together having a fun conversation.
Yeah. And the book does just that, right? There's a lot of great stories and there's some great humor in it. But in the end, it is prescriptive. You know, you come out with the five principles, right, of empathy. Is principles the word that you use in that?
Five
steps. There we go. Even more prescriptive. So it does lead to that. So it's very much in line with what you're saying. So with that, I mean, you really are kind of known for empathy, both personally and sort of being the expert, I think, in the industry. So with that in mind, as you, from where your vantage point, where you see, where do you see the future of insights heading? Is it related to empathy, or is it something else?
I believe it is actually. I mean, it's not the only thing that's going on, and there will always be new things coming in, but it's, if you're an insights professional, you have to be a master at empathy, because it's not just about having empathy with the consumer or the client, but also with your stakeholder and understanding their needs, and then being able to help them make that connection themselves.
Yes.
So that you're not always the one saying, but wait, the consumer feels this, or they think that. You've got to do that. And then, you know, going back to the thing that Elizabeth Oates from Ulta had posted, talking about how we have so much data, but do we really have insights through all of that data? And we need to know the context and the why. And to really connect to that, that is all about empathy. So
yeah,
we've got all this big data churning and spinning, and we're synthesizing and analyzing it. But if we're not able to connect to it and really understand what's going on. So, and empathy is seeing the point of view of somebody else. So empathy is so crucial to doing that, that anybody that's in the insights business should be, you know, an empathy Olympian, basically, and like really tuned in and have strong muscles and be in peak shape to practice.
Yes, absolutely. I love that. I love the recognition that it applies to stakeholders. That's what we do. We're trying to, they're investing, and we're trying to make sure that the right changes are made for the consumer, for them, and we have to know them and what they're, you know, what they're all about in order to get that message across. So super cool. All right. So Rob, this is a podcast, right? You've been on many podcasts. You probably consume a few, but just thinking about the broad world of media, what do you turn to for insights, inspiration, or enjoyment?
Oh, I'm okay. So I always read the Washington Post and the New York Times every day.
Okay.
Definitely picking that in. I pay attention to what's sort of trending in LinkedIn news, because I spend a fair amount of time on LinkedIn every day. Mm-hmm. Different Kevin Ryan has a newsletter called Culture Matters. It's really insightful. He focuses more in food, and so it's a little more CPG related, but
sure,
he's a very wonderful observer of trends and what's happening, he's an anthropologist by training and education. So he does a lot of background into what's happening and why things are happening. Rashad Tabakawala has another great one. He's an ex-publicist guy, and he does their podcast. Podcast wise, I love listening to The Assignment with Audie Cornish. She goes really, it's 30 minutes. She goes kind of deep, with a topic and a very specific question.
Sure.
And then there's another podcast called For Your Listening Pleasure with Mallory Waxman. And Mallory, she's out of Chicago. She's a marketer. She just gets these, I was a guest, so that's how I really got tuned into it. And we connected because she actually interviewed one of who I call my Peloton instructor, which is Christine Dercole. She had Mallory manage to get Christine as a guest. Mallory gets amazing guests for kind of her show, and they're fascinating, and they're people from very different fields and areas of thought. They're not all influencers or anything like that. So that's good. And then I try to keep myself young. And pay attention when I'm out on the street, things that I'm seeing. You're just always taking in this information, and then you never know how the dots are all going to connect. You know, that there were actually dots that were there.
Yeah. Yeah. Cool. All right. Well, you know that this is called the Rock and Roll Research Podcast, right? So we've talked a lot of research, but it's time to talk rock and roll, Rob. Fascinated what you're going to share for your answers to this question. Okay. I assume there's probably going to be some congruence between some of our likes, but okay. So you're stranded on a desert island, Rob. You have three records of your choosing to keep you company for the rest of your days. What are they?
Okay. So I'll count down 3, 2, 1. So number three, I don't have a physical representation of it, but It's probably, there's like a Dionne Warwick greatest hits album with a lot of the Burt Bacharach, Hal David music. So yeah. For me, when I need to get into the zone, I have curated this Pandora station that is it's Burt Bacharach radio, but it's got songs from the 60s into the early 70s. And it's the stuff that my parents must have been listening to when I was in the womb and really young. So when I need to get in the zone and kind of figure out how to, like, you know, do the thing to get me off this deserted island, like that's the one. It just, whenever I listen to that music, it just puts me in this clear mental space, and it has really unique power. So that would be number three.
I remember, did you used to watch Dionne when she hosted Solid Gold? Do you remember that show back then?
Yes, I do remember that.
That was my introduction to Dionne Warwick.
Okay, yeah. Did you catch the documentary about her that came out earlier this year?
No, I haven't.
So there's a Dionne Warwick, CNN Films did it. It's really good. They skip over the Psychic Network part. They talk about it very briefly. But it's definitely worth a watch.
Okay.
Because it gave me greater appreciation for her influence and impact in the music business then and even today, as she's a matriarch in the industry to a lot of up and coming Black artists. And I think that's awesome. Yeah. Okay. Number two, this is Kissing to Be Clever.
Yeah,
this has one of my all-time favorite songs on it, which is Time, Clock of the Heart, which is leads side two. I played that song to death when I was a kid. I'm a big Culture Club fan, you know, and I was not out at that time, but you just knew there was something there was something different about them, and I loved the sound. And so that one is number two, and we just got a turntable not too long ago, so we're like kind of bringing albums back in.
Awesome.
Number one, and anyone that really knows me will know this, and to anybody that was in college with me sophomore year, I'm still eternally apologizing because I played Kate Bush.
Oh, yes.
To death.
Good stuff.
Especially Running Up That Hill, which,
yep.
I mean, empathy is in art. It fuels art. That's what art is all about. Seeing the perspective of other people, connecting. But Running Up That Hill is about trading places. If I only could make a deal with God, get us to swap our places. Like, it's all about empathy.
Yeah.
It's amazing. I love Kate Bush. I got to see her live in concert in 2014, and she played, they did on stage, they brought to life the second, if we really can go deep for a second, the second side of this album is called The Ninth Wave, and it's a story. And that's the cool thing about Kate Bush. She's always experimenting, like, how do I make an album that really just tells a complete story? So they brought that to life on stage as one of the acts on her concert. And so when I found out that that's what they were doing, which was like that day, I avoided reviews and everything. Like, my brain just exploded. That was such an amazing experience.
That's and that one is just so crazy because all of a sudden, you know, my 17-year-old daughter was listening to Kate Bush all the time. And it's just the boomerang, the echo effect. I mean, I'm glad it was that song. It's so iconic.
Oh, yeah.
It's such a good song, but it was so unusual to see my youth, you know, bounce back in such a big way.
Yeah. I teared up when the scene in particular where on Stranger Things, where Kate Bush, that song saves that student. I mean, then that's, I had connected, I was going through some emotional, an unrequited crush, as often happens to gay youth of a certain age. And that song really just helped me kind of get through it. So it saved me in some ways. And that's why I kept playing it over and over and over and over again, because I was just going through so much pain. So to see that represented or reflected in pop culture and on Stranger Things, like, was really meaningful for me.
Yeah.
So
I love it.
And I'm so excited that now she's, you know, Kate Bush is finding a new audience is now finding her in that younger generation. And, you know, they're really exploring her music because it's varied and amazing and just incredible stuff. She's an artist.
Yes, absolutely. Couldn't agree more. It's really interesting too. I think those are three brand new mentions on the podcast. I think those are all unique mentions. Nice. So three really cool choices. Excellent.
Thank you.
Well, I have to say, Rob, you know, the hype is worth it. So
thank you.
No, it's true. I really am glad that we've had a chance to meet. Love this chat. Maybe you're going to Quirks coming up in July. I'm not sure.
I will be at Quirks, New Wonderful. York. You can find me at the bookseller booth. Usually I'll have the book and saying hi and, you know, floating around the hall for sure.
Super cool. Well, I can't wait to catch up a little bit more in person. It's been a great chat and it's been really great getting to know you. So let's talk soon. Quirks, if not sooner. And thanks so much and rock and roll.
Yeah.